But the reality is, it is very plausible for us to emerge in this reality where the brain becomes a weapon, or a weapon, but also a target, not just in like a hard, we're fighting, this is kinetic warfare type thing, but the stuff that happens before an outright war.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com in a conversation that's being recorded in April of 2024. And today I have the great honor of presenting to you a first-time guest on The Corbett Report, and perhaps to introduce you to a writer who I think whose work is worth your attention. I'm talking about Stavroula Pabst, who is available at, well, a number of different places and published widely online, but perhaps the best place to go might be her Substack at stavroulapabst.substack.com. And if you have any problem spelling that, don't worry, the link will be in the show notes for this conversation in case you need it. She describes herself as a journalist and comedy writer interested in history and international politics, which is quite a mixture. So I think we need to delve into that. And she writes at her Substack a Tech X Geopolitics, Tech Times Geopolitics update, in which she talks about the convergence, the intersection of technology and geopolitics. For example, one of her recent updates talks about the Lavender AI-powered kill list that Israel is employing in Gaza. So that's probably worth your time and attention. And hopefully you've seen some of the other things that I've referenced of hers in the past. For example, an article that she wrote last October for UnlimitedHangout.com on how Peter Thiel-linked tech is fueling the Ukraine war. And also a article that I linked up in the recommended reading section of the a recent subscriber newsletter. A really, really excellent, really fascinating article for PropagandaInFocus.com on Guy Debord's warning of the role of the expert, a philosophical perspective on the rise of fact-checking, which is really, really, honestly, worth your time and attention. Please do go and read it. But today we're going to talk about something else entirely. We're going to talk about an article that she wrote recently that was published up on UnlimitedHangout.com last month called Weaponizing Reality, The Dawn of Neural Warfare. So let's welcome her onto the program. Stavroula Pabst, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, let's start, since this is your first time. Let's talk a little bit about yourself and your background. A comedy writer, journalist, interested in politics and technology and the intersection of geopolitics and technology. How on earth did you get into this writing, and why?
Kind of oddly enough, I mean, I've been interested in journalism for some time on and off, and I have studied history at school. So I suppose some of that kind of works together a little bit. I'm currently a PhD media candidate at a university here in Greece. So over time, I've kind of realized, like, I've covered geopolitics for a while. I think that what I've realized is that more coverage of the tech industry by people who do a lot of geopolitical writing, that needs a lot of focus right now. So as a result of that, I've kind of accidentally gotten into this weird area where I never studied tech related things whatsoever in school, but I realized we really need to do these types of things to better understand what's going to come in the future. So of course that meant writing the article we're going to discuss today. I've also tried to get more into crypto in recent months, just because I do think understanding crypto and understanding the future of finance and financial infrastructure in general is critical to understanding the politics of the future. So they're tricky topics because I'm kind of learning some of these things like over time myself. I really like to present this info. I like larger articles like the one I wrote because these in-depth dives are needed, but I also like producing a newsletter where it's like, all right, here's what I think and I have noticed what's going on. I will show this to the audience. So I write for a variety of publications, but I also do like doing some independent work for these reasons so that I can, you know, say, hey, here's my findings, here's the politics of it, etc. Some of it's just kind of accidental. Like if you study history for a while, I don't want to be a historian. I prefer applying that to today. Comedy writing, also an accident. I don't know. I just do stand up a lot.
Fascinating. What an interesting mixture of hobbies and interests. And if people are wondering, What does that mean, the intersection of technology and geopolitics? Well, this article that we're going to be talking about today is an excellent example of that. And speaking of in-depth dives, it's a pretty lengthy, voluminous article. But I am tickled to say that as someone who has been following developments in this space for one or two decades at this point, there was a lot of information in here that was new to me. There's tons and tons and tons of references. So I guess I'm a total nerd because I found that delightful, and I'm very glad to present it to the audience. So I hope people will check it out. It's called Weaponizing Reality, The Dawn of Neurowarfare, and the subhead here on unlimitedhangout.com says that Stavroula Papst explores the race to apply emerging neurotechnologies such as brain-computer interfaces, BCIs, in times of both war and peace, expanding conflicts into a new domain, the brain, while perhaps forever changing humans' relationship with machines, which is quite an introduction. So I imagine that there are probably quite a few people in the Corbett Report audience who have some inkling of the BCI / BMI nightmare dystopia that we are sleepwalking into at the moment, if for no other reason than it has been introduced to the public consciousness in recent months by that technocratic huckster extraordinaire Elon Musk and the Neuralink brain chip, which is being seeded into the public consciousness right now. But for people who are completely new to this space, just tell us a little bit about this BCI technology and what it promises / threatens.
Sure. And this is obviously a critical place to start. As you said, I think that Elon Musk's Neuralink, the recent brain computer interface implant, I think it was somebody's brain, like first human brain in January or something. Obviously, that had made a lot of headlines. In short, brain computer interfaces are a way of very quickly your brain or your mind's thoughts are being transposed into action through this device, right? Very simply, that means if I think, if let's say my brain is hooked up to a coffee machine for some reason, and I'm like, make coffee. I just think that, and theoretically, it's enough to do that. I'm not convinced that the primary thing that they would hook your brain up to be would be a coffee machine, but that's a very simple way of explaining. The point of this is to say you think something and then it can happen. That sounds simple. I think what's being marketed here, a lot of things are being marketed by various people. If we think about Neuralink, for example, they clearly say that they would like to enhance able-bodied performance of people. So I think that that needs to be put first and foremost. We're talking about people who are not just simply trying to help others. They're trying to improve humans, which I think is already pretty weird from the start. That being said, a lot of different things are being promoted in this respect. People are promoting BCIs as means to cure things like paralysis, for example. Obviously, this same type of tech, a lot of people are pushing these health benefits, but they're critically, as we'll get into, this is also about promoting what can be done at times of war, or what can be done for war fighters. So the same tech that can help cure paralysis, for example, perhaps that could help a prosthetic limb touch again. Well, if we're talking about something like a brain computer interface, what's going on a lot of the time right now is that brain computer interfaces aren't about operating coffee machines, like I said. They're really being applied towards things like using the brain to communicate directly and operate things like drones, things like tanks, whatever other machinery that your brain could be implemented to control. I think the military has an interest in trying to do that. They're essentially saying that this is a way to speed things up, make things as convenient as possible, while also saying, you know, perhaps the brain still has the ability to discern things in ways that other technologies do not have, right? And I've done a lot of AI reporting, as you had mentioned earlier. I think there's still a lot of interest in this neurotechnology component because they want to make military machines, military processes work faster using as much brain power as possible where you don't lose human discernment. So in short, we're seeing that this type of technology is very quickly being marketed to us both as a way to help people, to help improve people in ways that I think are oddly, you know, improve or surpass able-bodied performance, but also there's a clear military component, which I'm happy to get into. And there has been a military component from the very beginning. I don't think that BCIs are separable from the military-industrial complex. I struggle with whether that's the right word or not, but I don't think that those things are separable in any meaningful context.
Well, as I say, I have been following this for a couple decades, and all of the marketing that I've seen for this technology, essentially, the propaganda rollout, has always been about helping crippled people to type, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be mean to those crippled people, do you? So you must support and embrace this technology. Whereas, as you quite correctly point out, this is not about helping crippled people to type, or, it'll be a nice upgrade. You'll be able to wake up in the morning and get the coffee machine going before you get out of bed. Yay. Wonderful. No, this is about controlling unmanned aerial vehicles and or tinkering with other people's minds. You want to tinker with the enemy's minds so that you can disrupt their cognitive functions, etc. And you have a lot of information along those lines in this article. For example, you point to a 2020 NATO-backed paper that I hadn't seen before about cognitive warfare, talking about the brain being the battle space of the 21st century, etc., etc. But let's go back to the roots of this, because you also link up a Psychology Today article by Dr. Wallace Mendelson that goes into the World War II roots of neuroscience and neurotechnology and ultimately neurowarfare. As you say, this has been from the beginning a military-focused application. Let's talk about the military focus of the various entities that are involved in funding this technology.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out, because I literally think that this has always been neuroscience and war in general. I think that there has always been a critical link. My understanding, as that article points out, is the foundations of neurology are based in the Civil War, and then neuroscience more or less has a basis in World War II and beyond. I think a lot of people may be pretty aware of government projects like MKUltra, where a large variety of institutions had carried out brainwashing experiments, let's say. There was also Project Artichoke that had very weirdly specific, I believe that this was about trying to make people involuntarily carry out assassinations. So experiments to make these things happen were carried out in the years following World War II to see in what capacity could you manipulate people, especially in sensitive arrangements, military arrangements, etc. Now, we can talk a little bit about DARPA. What's critical to understand is that this weird MKUltra stuff hasn't really ended. It's just gone on to other things. If you go look at DARPA's language surrounding this topic, I found them say essentially like DARPA has a legacy, a decades-long legacy of funding the neurotechnologies, right? And I think that that's quite apparent if you look at their extensive research projects over the years. In the 1990s, for example, and you can check the exact links in my article, there was some extensive funding that led to projects where I suppose you could say primitive BCIs were tested with, where experimenters were testing and they were able to essentially teach monkeys. So we've linked this monkey's brain to be able to read its signals so that the monkey thinks and then the cursor and the computer moves. So they were funding a lot of that technology in like the 1990s. The reality is they've been thinking about this type of tech, how do you get the brain to think things and then it happens, for quite a long time. I think in the modern day, my understanding is that DARPA funds about half of the BCI-related projects that are ongoing in the United States. I think that they can be described as effectively driving BCI research, generally speaking. So that needs to be understood, that they are the ones driving this. And when that comes into more modern iterations, we can talk about something like the Brain Initiative, right? So the Brain Initiative, which I believe was founded in 2013 under the Obama administration, it's been funded to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's being marketed, and I'm not saying they're not also doing this, you know, it's being marketed as essentially an extensive project for public health, where researchers are trying to map out the brain in as much entirety as possible. So they're telling us publicly this is a major public health initiative so that we can better understand how the brain works, so that we can cure problems, better understand how to prevent problems in the future like Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is that DARPA is like the primary funder of this project, right? So it's being marketed as this face forward public health initiative. And I'm not saying that there isn't a public health component. Granted, okay, we can talk about public health, but separate discussion. You know, what's really going on though is that DARPA has a clear interest in using the BRAIN Initiative and these developments to its own ends. I link this to this in the article as well. I'm a little bit curious about this. There's a page called DARPA and the BRAIN Initiative that was live when I started writing this article. Curiously, it has been taken down since, so I'm very curious about that. But I have an archived version on the article. So you should read that because it explains DARPA's relationship with the BRAIN Initiative and how developments or advancements in the BRAIN Initiative are then being applied to military ends. So they describe a number of projects and they are just, honestly, they're ridiculous. I don't really know how else to explain them. I just think they're ridiculous, but they're talking about doing things like figuring out how to help people heal, perhaps in a battlefield context where if you are injected with an ultra miniature device, the plan would be that hopefully that would heal you if you were injured, for example. Some of the other stuff is similar to things we've discussed. They're trying to also do things, DARPA is trying to use things from the BRAIN Initiative to work on projects where, again, you're trying to be able to read brain signals fast enough to be able to operate military machinery quickly. Things like this, they're trying to use similar research again to make prosthetic limbs feel. So what we're seeing is that there are clear military applications of what is learned from the BRAIN Initiative, and that needs to be talked about first and foremost. They can talk about this from a public health perspective all they'd like, but the reality of the matter is that I think the underbelly of this is the military applications of the material, right?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that the DARPA is scrubbing potentially some of their BRAIN Initiative information, because in fact, now that you mention it, I believe that that NATO-backed paper that I mentioned earlier was getting a 404, so I had to use the Wayback Machine to find it. So at any rate, yeah, this information is not as readily accessible as it used to be, and there may be a reason behind that. Well, obviously, the first order application of this technology is quite obvious, as we've been talking about, using essentially a BCI, brain chip, brain computer interface, as an extension, a way to extend your body into a machine of some sort. And yes, that could be used to help crippled people type or what have you. It could also be used to help battlefield participants manipulate unmanned aerial vehicles with their mind, etc. But in fact, it gets even crazier than that when you start really drilling into this technology. And of course, we're going to raise the specter of Dr. James Giordano, who will probably be familiar to my regular listeners by now, because I have referred to him a few times, including in my episode on Designing Humans for Fun and Profit. This is the very interesting lecturer who you can find some of his lectures online, and I'd suggest you at least check them out, because he's quite animated about the possibilities of neurowarfare and likes to talk about them at length. And in interesting and obviously well-informed ways, he clearly knows a thing or two about what he's talking about. And he has raised the specter of various ways that this technology, neurotechnology generally, can be applied as a disruptive battlefield weapon. From neural disruption weapons to even getting opponents changing their thoughts, their perceptions, their feelings, they're manipulating their minds on the most basic level. Let's talk about this intersection of this particular type of technology and geopolitics. What are the potential geopolitical ramifications for the development of neurowarfare?
Yeah, and I this is obviously a complicated topic, so I'll try to boil this down as much as I can. I think your audience knows this very well, but obviously, in addition to just covert kinetic warfare, countries forever have always been interested in soft power. You know, of course, the United States, through things like the National Endowment for Democracy, for example, essentially CIA front, let's be honest, you know, they've been using institutions like that for decades now to try to influence public opinion in other countries so that, you know, the populations of other countries become more pliable for the U.S. goals in the region, right? So obviously, countries are always thinking, they are always thinking about new ways that they can kind of apply their will without resorting to these harder power techniques where perhaps you do have to bring in hard warfare, right? I think that the implications of this are especially dangerous. And I want to be clear that while it is a little bit more speculative, because it's not like we've seen so much of this in the real world yet, we're seeing it. The reality is that if you are able to master neuroweaponry in ways where you can manipulate people, literally manipulate their minds, it seems that the sky is the limit in terms of what you could do to a population before there's any actual fighting. And I think that Giordano actually has some pretty interesting quotes in this respect, because he's talking about how non-kinetic efforts or covert efforts by states can be pretty difficult to calculate, right? Like, let's say you have the capacities, you've mastered the capacities to manipulate minds. And let's say I'm a country that doesn't like other country. Well, let's say I've decided I'm going to do it. I'm going to use whatever neuroweaponry I have in my arsenal to manipulate. I'm making this up. This is a theoretical scenario. But let's say I brainwash 10% of a country's population. Well, I literally just changed people's brains. I literally brainwashed people on a mass scale. The geopolitical implications in terms of how that population will react, well, that population is now completely unstable. If they've been manipulated in ways to be skeptical of their government, you've just undermined that country's stability in a very tangible way. At the same time, it's not like I bombed your embassy like Israel just did. So the norms in terms of how to respond to something like this are now very complicated, because, you know, are you going to retaliate with neuroweaponry? Like, are you going to try to do that to be able to maintain your balance within a complicated geopolitical context? That could get really dicey really quickly. And I think, unfortunately, countries that are thinking ahead on this, the reality is the United States, I've talked about the most, but the United States is not the only country that has tried to develop this tech. You know, China has similar initiatives. The European Union has similar initiatives, et cetera. I think they're all thinking in this capacity, whether or not they want to say it. I think, as you had said, they don't want this stuff to be very clear in terms of what capacities they do or don't have. They don't want the public to know, but they also don't want, I think they don't want other countries to know. I don't know what your thoughts on that are, but regardless of what they're trying to cover up, they're thinking very much in the mindset of, if I don't have this neurotechnology within this capacity that other countries do have, this means that when we're fighting in some extent, or if there are other soft power competitions going on, I will lose in ways that are difficult for me to predict, right? So I think, unfortunately, what this also is forcing is a kind of race to develop these technologies, whether they be things like BCIs or people like Dr. Giordano, but also other researchers have talked about other, perhaps the propensity of other mass-scale weaponry that could manipulate populations, or, you know, could this be done with certain drugs, for example, right? Some of that's a little bit more speculative, but the reality is, based on the fact that we know governments have been playing with this tech for decades and decades and decades, means that we can't say for sure what will happen, but the reality is, it is very plausible for us to emerge in this reality where the brain becomes a weapon, or a weapon, but also a target, not just in like a hard, like, we're fighting, this is kinetic warfare type thing, but the stuff that happens before an outright war. And okay, we may be talking about things that could happen decades from now, but I think we have to have that conversation. Maybe not I don't know. Whenever they do it, we have to be having this conversation now so that we're aware for it, because I really think that they will do anything based on anything history has taught me about this topic.
Exactly right. I mean, the military-industrial complex is nothing if not completely unimaginative. So the exact same arguments that were used, for example, with the nuclear arms race and the bioweapons arm race, if we don't do it, they're going to do it. So that is always, always the tactic that is used to make sure that this technology is heavily funded and heavily financed. And so on that note, we see, of course, DARPA, as you say, being a prime funder in the U.S. context, but it's happening elsewhere. And you note, for example, the Japanese program and other programs around the world that are working on similar brain initiatives that have, of course, this dual-use potentiality. It could be for helping paralyzed people. It could also be used, it could be weaponized very easily. So that is the situation we find ourselves in. And we are talking potentially, again, this is speculative and we don't know all the details of what is going on in the skunk works of the Pentagon, etc. But the potentially manipulating people right down to the core of their personality, who they are, what they think, the way that they experience their own emotions and feelings and what they think about the world, that is incredibly, unbelievably violative. So won't somebody come and help us? Oh, thankfully, there are legislators in Chile who are passing legislation to protect neuro rights. What on earth is happening on that front?
Yeah, so that's been a fun rabbit hole and a very frustrating rabbit hole because, you know, I think a normal response somebody would have to what I just discussed is, I would like to limit or ban this technology, right? Like a lot of people would hear what I just said and want normal controls, or they would want reasonable debate about what should be done about this technology, because unfortunately, whether we like it or not, some of its arrival in society is likely inevitable at this point, considering the current status of the research, right? Unfortunately, I think that this neuro right stuff is, maybe PSYOP is the right word, I'm not sure. At the very least, it's very much controlled opposition, where the people that are positing neuro rights or putting it forward, they literally have developed, a lot of them have developed the very technology we've been discussing, right? And their proximity to these projects needs, at the very bare minimum, it needs to be questioned, right? So when we talk about neuro rights legislation, who's pushing it, why, et cetera. So neuro rights, as you said, Chile is the first country that's like put it in as like a constitutional amendment, which is kind of wild. Like they literally transformed their constitution. So one of the primary people behind neuro rights, as I understand it, and I can do more to explain a little bit about what these neuro rights are and their limitations. But neuro rights were brought to Chile by Dr. Rafael Yuste. What needs to be said on from right from the bat is that he literally had helped pitch the BRAIN initiative to the Obama administration over 10 years ago now, right? So this person with very close proximity to a heavily DARPA-influenced project is now saying, oh, I'm worried about this now. I'm going to come in and I'm going to bring neuro rights. So now it's not so scary. And I think what's frustrating about this, like we can talk about the specific neuro rights, that proximity very much needs to be questioned. On top of that, I think that the neuro rights themselves need to be questioned because, you know, if this is being brought forward by someone who's created this technology, then what do neuro rights actually do? So this forces us to talk a little bit about what the neuro rights being proposed are, how they look, problems with them, etc. So I might even have a list of them with me, but some the neuro rights are essentially about protecting mental privacy, stuff like this. It's about, in theory, preventing the data in your brain that's collected by whatever neurotechnology being developed by being sold to third parties, or your mental, you know, what's in your brain could be sold to somebody else. They're trying to stop this. They say that they want to provide equal access to augmented cognition, which I think is, I will get into this. I think is particularly weird. And they also would like you to have freedom from bias. So if people try to transform your brain, apparently they can't put problematic thoughts in you. I'm not sure. I think a lot of people would say that they agree with something like mental privacy. Obviously, I want mental privacy. This is a frustrating thing because they're, in some ways, they're proposing things that if you don't really look into it, maybe it sounds nice. At the same time, it's like, even if that is legislated, who's going to enforce it? You know, if somebody has actually messed with your brain, would you know? How would you be able to advocate for yourself? If your brain's data is sold somehow, I very much question anyone's ability to reasonably stop that within the context of our privacy online is essentially zero right now. It is zero. Do you really trust any government to be able to protect you, even if it's legislated against, right? We can move on a little bit to discuss the one that I think is quite silly, which is equitable access to augmented cognition, which I just think is a bizarre neuro right in the first place for a couple of reasons. First of all, by pushing the equitable access, we're not necessarily having a critical discussion about whether the technology should be allowed in the first place. Maybe a more reasonable legislative standpoint would be to start there, right? But they're essentially pushing this equitable access thing. And I think, unfortunately, equitable access can kind of be used as a type of bludgeon, right? Because if everybody has equal access, I think that that forces societal pressures to using the technology. Like, let's say there are brain computer interfaces that now allow you to think 10% faster. I'm making that up, but let's say this is a good example of something that they could offer. Well, maybe at first it'll just be like, hey, if you'd like to get this, you can do it, and it's easy to get. They'll say it like that, but it automatically forces societal pressures because if a lot of people get that, they'll get better jobs, they'll get into better schools, they'll have a hand over you in all of society. This forces a lot of pressure on the population to get technology they may not want to, right? And I think that that paves the way for its normalization in society, which is what I actually think this is about, to be quite clear. Even worse with that one, I just think that this is wild that they're trying to push equitable access, because even if we agreed with equitable access, do you think that equitable access would happen in every country? No, I think it would pave the way. I literally think that it would pave the way for something like this country's people is now 15% smarter than everybody else's because they all got this implant. So it would become a very horrible eugenics-y population competition where you're just trying to up your population's mental capacity, which I know that sounds insane, but I literally think that that's the stuff that's trying to be could be normalized depending on how it is applied. But as I said earlier, I think that this equitable access stuff is what this type of legislation is really about. I think legislation like this is about normalizing BCI introduction, not just in the military sphere like we've discussed, but I think it's also about making it seem normal and seem more friendly to everyday people within a standard concept, within a standard day-to-day life, right? Where it's not so scary to have that because now you have this legislation that theoretically protects you, even though the people that created this have these close ties to the very industries. They are the people that developed this technology, okay? I think that it needs to be questioned for those reasons. And I think what's upsetting about this is that if you're a lay person, neuro rights sound nice, they sound good, but if they are implemented haphazardly, I fear that this type of mass implementation of BCIs could be normalized. And I think what's critical to say also is that Neuro rights are not just being considered in Chile. They've been introduced or considered in a number of countries. If I remember correctly, Colorado had recently passed some similar legislation, so I plan on looking into that soon. So this is kind of just standard. This is what's happening these days, is that policy initiatives are being started from the top up somewhere. In this case, it seems to be with Dr. Rafael Yuste. And now it's being introduced in a number of countries. And Chile, as your audience likely knows, has kind of a history of being used as like a neoliberal testing ground. So we're dealing with this situation where these are being pushed as kind of a solution, but in reality, they're forcing, I don't know if force is the right word, they're normalizing this technology within day-to-day life in ways that do seem to be quite dangerous. That's it in short. But I find it to be very concerning because it looks like it's very nice. But I think if you scrutinize it, it falls apart quickly.
You raise a number of important points there, one of which is that neuro rights are just words on paper in the exact same way that all of the other amendments to all the other constitutions are words on paper, and in the same way that, don't worry, Americans, you have a Fourth Amendment that protects you from unlawful search and seizure unless the NSA is snooping behind the scenes, snarfing up all your data, and that might come out years later, and nothing will ever happen, and they'll just retroactively rubber stamp it and say it was okay anyway. It's totally meaningless. It means nothing. And to the extent that such things are ever enforced, it will only ever be selectively enforced against enemies of the cabal that are actually stewarding over this technology, which raises the other point that you definitely bring up there for good reason. Equitable access, to me, means that ultimately the peons and serfs at the bottom level of the economic power pyramid, you guys can all have the sort of childlike version of this, but the real, if there is actual technology that could truly transform humanity, what do you bet that that's stewarded over and selectively given to the military and the people in positions of power first and foremost? And of course, we even tend to internalize the structures that are given to us in these arms race type of scenarios where it's nation state versus nation state. And maybe Russia is trying to do this to improve their population and America is trying. I don't think that's an accurate reflection of reality. No, it is a global cabal of oligarchs and financiers who steward over the global system, and they don't care what your nationality is. They're going to steward this technology for themselves. So there are, incredibly important points to be raised, because we are also conditioned to think a rights movement is a wonderful thing. It's like civil rights or what have you. How could you be against that? No, this is part of the formation of steady and effective markets for this technology that they can use to sell and normalize the technology to the public. And, oh yeah, by the way, they'll keep the good stuff for themselves behind the scenes. So it's just it's a nightmare on every level. But a few times in this conversation now, you have raised the specter, and rightfully so. This is all very speculative. We don't know really the limits and capabilities and what they have developed, what they will ultimately be able to develop with regards to these technologies, which, I'm sure this isn't your first rodeo in the independent media, is going to bring to mind of skeptical people in the independent media space. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's all nonsense. They can't do anything. They're not going to be able to mind control anyone. All of it is total garbage, and it's essentially just a grist that they're trying to get money out of. What would be your response to that sort of reaction?
That this is just, I'm not sure I understand. You mean that this is kind of a hustle, or that this isn't really going to come into
fruition?
Exactly
right. That the technology doesn't work, that they'll never be able to control people's minds or anything like they're promising.
I see. I think that we have to be clear that, you know, I realize that this stuff sounds like it is in the future. The reality, though, is what I'm referencing is, as you said, I'm referencing a lot of academics who are researching this stuff in depth. These are some of the conclusions they've talked about extensively regarding both the technologies, but also their possible geopolitical implications. I think the reality is that anybody who thinks that this stuff is not possible needs to understand what has already been done, right? Obviously, we'll see what happens with Neuralink. The reality, though, is that even if Elon Musk is not competent, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have a lot of money to fund this stuff and make it reality, right? This stuff has been going on for decades. The reality of DARPA's funding is that it is very extensive. It is given to prominent research universities and institutions to develop the tech. Even if it doesn't occur right now, the reality is a lot of it has already been gamed out at the institutional level. And I would also say that, you know, even if you don't believe what I'm saying with neurosciences right now, what's happened really quickly that should probably force you to rethink is the very quick emergence of AI, right? Obviously, AI has been something tested out for a while. I'm not trying to be like, oh, AI is new. AI is not new. But what's happened, you know, from the public, I guess I'll talk a little bit about the public rollout, right? Like ChatGPT has been around for more than a year. And I think that was a very public presentation of like, see, you can do this now. Well, that was like a little bit more than a year ago, and it's already being widely used in the battlefield, right? I think most people can't really deny that. Maybe they don't know necessarily about the ramifications of it, but the reality right now is that AI-powered tech is powering lethal drones in places like Ukraine. It is directing military targeting to much faster, hundreds of times faster than human intelligence can do in places like Gaza. So what I'm trying to say is that if you see what's happened with the public introduction of AI versus its implementation on the battlefield, that was very fast, right? And unfortunately with that, we're in an arena where there's been little public debate because it's moved so fast, it's been able to kind of sidestep a lot of critical discussions. So if you don't think that the same thing at least could happen with the neurosciences, I have to say, I think that that contradicts decades of research that has been very steadily invested in by groups like DARPA. Okay, I think that you're actively ignoring decades of research and the reality of how military technologies tend to be implemented. I mean, I am curious to see how this games out. We don't know for sure what will happen. Of course, that's the case, but it's also the case that in general, the defense industry is very interested in tech like this. And there's also just a lot of money in it right now because geopolitically, I think countries think, okay, regardless of what's happening, I think that they think that we're in a larger period of conflict and war, which means that there's a lot of attention in developing these technologies to the utmost capacity, right? The weapons sector in the United States is booming. That's assisted by venture capital, but that's another discussion for a later time. But there's a lot of focus in this area right now. The technology develops rapidly. And I think that if you don't want to look into this, that's on you. That is your choice. But I think that you're ignoring critical developments in terms of how they could play out on the world stage in terms of geopolitical implications, but perhaps most importantly, how day-to-day life could change for you and me if this tech is introduced into the mainstream.
To be clear, I agree with you on this. I think that there is a demonstrable inverse correlation between people's knowledge of the white papers and technical papers and the NATO-backed documents and the DARPA documents, etc., the decades of research that's gone into this, and people's credulity with regards to the possibility of this technology. And I think if there is a PSYOP going on here, it is the PSYOP to convince people in the independent media who would presumably be against this technology, don't worry, there's nothing to see, they're not doing anything, don't worry about it, go look somewhere else. Don't look over here, guys. That's generally a sign that that's something that you probably should actually invest your time in learning more about. And if you are interested in learning more about the subject, I'm going to direct people once again to this article. We've spent the better part of an hour talking about it now and have only barely skimmed the surface. There's so much information in here. For example, as you point out in our conversation and as you link in this article, the Neuralink, wow, look at this, we made a monkey play pong with his brain, wow, was stuff that DARPA was doing in the 1990s. This is not new. This is not some breakthrough revelation that, yay, Elon Musk has given to the masses. This is old technology, so can you imagine what they are not showing the public yet? On that note, I think we'll wrap up the conversation here. As I say, there's a lot to go into, so I hope people will check out this article in particular. and the other articles that I mentioned earlier and the your newsletter in general, tell people the best places that they can find your work.
Sure. So as said earlier, my Substack is probably the best way to keep up with my work because I like to put semi-frequent newsletters there. I will direct people to articles that I've published there. So that's stavroulapaps.substack.com. I also do have an X account, which I question whether I really want to use it, but you can also follow me there. My name is just Stavroula Pabst on there. So those are probably the best places to find me. And I hope to be kind of doing the same work that I have been doing. I increasingly, obviously, I do cover geopolitics, but I am increasingly trying to also cover the tech developments, especially in regards to war, but also just in general. So if you would like to focus more on the tech aspects of the geopolitical world, I try to cover it because I've noticed there really isn't as much critical coverage as is needed. These are complicated topics. And they really do deserve this type of critical attention. It is complex. It literally has me here learning crypto. I taught myself crypto. I'm now teaching myself neuroscience to try to do this because I think that if you're only looking at the geopolitical aspect, obviously that is important. I think you're missing out on how these tech developments really could change things overnight and at any time. And I think that now, like, this current period in history is really critical with that because everything is moving so quickly right now. I think it's easy to sneak up technologies that could transform society radically. I think the neurosciences can do that. I think AI can do that. I think new financial infrastructures can do that, for example. So I think it's critical for anybody in media in general, but especially in the geopolitics space, to be focusing on this. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, sign me up. You don't have to convince me. I think this is an important area to study. I think, as you say, there aren't enough people who are spending time and research capability on this. So I'm glad you are. I'll be following your work. But here's the real question. How can people see your stand-up?
Should I post it? Like,
yes.
come to Athens. I will just do some stand up. I guess I should post it because I really don't publish too much of that. I do write for Reductress. So basically I just write dick jokes and then they publish them sometimes. So I'll be like, here's this, which is very, my professional interests are very bizarre at this point, but I'll post stand up at some point.
I'm just fascinated by the mixture there. I'm making me think maybe I should give a try at stand-up. Anyway, all right, yeah, we'll leave it there. Stavroula Pabst, thank you for coming on. I hope we get a chance to talk again in the future.
Yep, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.